again, folks, to Podcasting Him Softly. My very special guest today is none other than writer, director, producer, Hank Braxton, the maker of such films. Blood Effects, Chemical Peel, Unnatural, the vastly approaching Snake Out of Compton, as well as many short films and television. Hank, you've also done lots of multiple other jobs, acting, assistant camera, makeup, all that sort of stuff.
I don't say acting. I'm a terrible actor. I stay away from it.
But anyway, mate, it's great to have you on Podcasting Softly. Thank you for coming on. Could we get from you perhaps a sort of a little bio leading up to your career as it began, sort of your beginnings?
Well, I guess like a lot of filmmakers, I just kind of, you know, grew up as a child sort of making movies with a home video camera, that kind of thing.
Right.
And eventually kept doing that through high school, like, so that was a lot of fun. But then I joined the Army, so for a little while I didn't make any films, but I started doing it again in the military, and they seemed to really enjoy that, so I ended up making a lot of movies, actually, shorts and things for the Army. They would climb a defense and stuff, and I really liked that. And that was when I was like, maybe I could get out and go to film school and go after that. So I did. I left when my service was up in the Army. I went to film school and then eventually moved to Hollywood and started working professionally.
Wow. And so what was your first gigs when you got out there?
I'm sorry, what was one of my first gigs?
Yeah, or some of your early gigs when you came to Hollywood.
I started working at a production company that specialized mostly in reality TV.
Okay.
And like the first thing I did, like within like 2 months of being in Hollywood, was like I was on this show called Destination Truth, Josh Yates, and that was the first season of that, and funny enough, though, like the first place we went was Papua New Guinea, and so I was there for like a week or so, and we were looking for like an iguanodon and a mermaid and stuff like that, and so that was interesting. I continued to work on a lot of reality TV after that, but you know, slowly moved up the food chain.
Ghostbusters,
yeah,
Ghostbusters is evidently something that you treasure.
Yeah, it was one of the most influential films, I'd say, on me growing up.
Yeah,
other than, you know, Star Wars, of course, which is for everybody.
Right. So it's it was a big motivator.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating film. You know, as a kid, you watch it and like the effects are great and the proton pack's super cool and it's got monsters and stuff. But you know, when you start watching it as an adult and the humor starts to click with you, then you can enjoy it in a whole different way.
Mm. And were you a fan of 2?
Here's what I say about 2. I think of it as like, it's like Alien 3.
Right.
Like, by itself, I think it's a solid film. It's just, if you compare it to the film that came right before it, it's terrible.
Right. And obviously, you'd probably have mixed feelings about the most recent effort.
I'm sorry?
I said obviously you'd have mixed feelings then about the most recent effort.
I don't know how mixed they are. I thought it was a terrible idea from the get-go. Like, just the moment they're like, we're not going to use the original cast at all.
Right.
And it's not going to be a sequel, it's a reboot, you know, at which point I'm like, why would you do that? Like, you could have easily had the old guys in it, like, pass the torch to whoever the new team is.
Right.
But, you know, just my opinion. I knew the project was doomed, sadly, once I knew who was directing it and who was writing it. And that is not going to speak to, you know, their filmmaking ability, because I thought Bridesmaids was hilarious. But it's just, in my opinion, not the right tone or type of humor for Ghostbusters, so.
Yeah. In my opinion,
right. I'm correct. That's just my opinion. I'm sure somebody loved that movie.
Oh, look, there's probably a lot of people that did. I personally thought it was one of the most unfunny films that I think were supposed to be funny. I have a lot of films that I think are funny that are unintentionally funny. This is the first film I've encountered that is I think was supposed to be funny in some parts, but didn't come off as funny. I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
No, I think it's probably a lot of people. But like I said, as a filmmaker, I can tell you that no matter how hard you work on a film or what it is, like, you're always going to have people that say it's the worst movie ever made, and other people that like think it's the best movie ever made. So it's interesting. You never really get away from that.
Yeah, but no, I'm kind of in your boat. I think that the idea of rebooting it is always a really bad way to go. I mean, I think there's so much time that has passed, and I think if they were going to get back together and use the original guys, they should have done it. You know.
I'm not sure why they never really got that off the ground. I know that Dan Aykroyd was trying to make it happen for like the last 20 years, and it never really got there. And instead, you know, they kept making Men in Black films, which, you know, kind of Ghostbusters money. Apparently, that's the rumor.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen, like, you know, a version where the original cast come back and they're all older, and you know, it's a kind of like what Aykroyd's I think one of his initial drafts or his initial story was like it was some sort of future, and the Ghostbusters had been around for a long time, but they'd been around so long they'd been kind of reduced to like pest control, you know, and they were sort of their time of prominence had come and gone a long time ago. Kind of a little bit like where he was going with 2, but sort of a more extreme version than that. So like they were very commonplace. Like, oh, you've got a ghost, yeah, call the Ghostbusters. Kind of, but it was very, you know, they'd been reduced to a mediocrity almost. You know, so it would have been interesting to see like they're a bunch of like a lot older guys, and they're running this, you know, this little shoebox operation, and they used to be big, and they saved the city once or twice, and, you know, but now they're just essentially like roach killers, you know. So that would
I'll tell you, that's kind of the reason we made, you know, back in 2004, right before I went to film school, I made a fan film called Freddy vs. Ghostbusters.
Right.
And a couple of years later, we decided to do a sequel, but make it feature length. And, you know, it's not about Freddy. It's just about our Denver Ghostbusters as it is. And,
right.
I think to a large degree, it was because we were kind of tired of waiting for the studio to make one.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think, I think there are a great many sort of lost opportunities floating around out there, but, you know, until either one of us get the job running a major studio, then we'll we'll just have to sit and with our fingers crossed.
Critique everyone else's work.
Yeah. Anyway, so then we come to your feature filmmaking. So how did you, you know, obviously you work independently. How did you come to your first feature?
Which feature? I've made a lot of features. Pretty much like to say that Chemical Peel is really my first
feature. Sort of your first sort of, you know, widely.
It's the first feature length film that I made with the intent of selling it.
Right, yeah.
You know, trying to make it a professional film, whereas, you know, when Return of the Ghostbusters is a feature-length film, but
sure.
you know, we knew all along that, like, it's never going to be for sale. And, you know, it's pretty cheap. And it's just, you know, we're just making that for fun.
Yeah.
So Chemical Peel was a film that we wanted to do, you know, one of those horror films where you film the whole thing in your house because, you know, of course you don't have a huge budget. And so, you know, we had to come up with a storyline that would keep the characters confined in a house.
Right.
And that's when I recalled a story I heard, like, back in the 90s about there's a chemical spill, and the air all around this farm had, like, become, like, toxic, like chlorine. And so these people were just trapped in their farmhouse for, like, days waiting for people to come rescue them. And it was pretty tragic, actually. It, like, killed all their farm animals, stuff like that. They, like, survived. But, you know, we kind of took that story and made it way more extreme, and that's how you end up with Chemical Peel.
So, I mean, that it's sort of, did you find, you know, during the climate in which you went out then and tried to, you know, sell the film, you know, was it tough? I mean, I know it's always tough, but I mean, what was the climate like at that time trying to sell and market the, you know, Chemical Peel?
Well, I'll say it was easier than it is now.
Right.
Now it's much harder to sell a film because the market's even more saturated than it was before, and it's like it's because of technology.
Right.
And I like to say it's simultaneously best and worst time to be an independent filmmaker. And
yeah.
I mean, it's the best because the, you know, the equipment is so affordable and the editing is so affordable. It's like now you have a computer and a nice DSLR or something, and like you're good to go. You can make a movie. So the cost barrier of entry is so much lower. You know, for under $10,000, you can make a really solid film. Whereas it used to be, you'd spend, you know, six figures just on film so you could shoot the thing.
Yeah.
And so if naturally that's created a market where there are thousands of films coming out every year, and 10% of those are horror films that take place in a house.
Yeah. Yeah, the monster. Well, I mean, the monster, it's funny, I was reading a screenwriting friend of mine recommended a book to me. It was called Save the Cat. I don't know. Are you familiar with Save the Cat?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very familiar.
Yeah, the last screenwriting book you'll ever need or something like that. And
if you like formulaic writing,
yeah,
then Save the Cat is for you. And
yeah,
that's one of the complaints that people have about The Last Jedi, the new Star Wars film, that it's not formulaic, but...
Yeah.
I kind of respect that, actually. And I think that, like with any craft, it's imperative that you learn all the rules and get really good at them. Then you can start breaking them, and you know how to break them and
totally.
Still have the story, like, cohesive, you know? So, yeah, I think if you're starting out, if you're someone that's interested in being an independent filmmaker, and you totally should, it's a lot of fun. But, yeah, that's a good book to read. You know, read Save the Cat for screenwriting, you know, read about three-point lighting so you can, you know, light your stuff, learn how to do some sound, and, like, you can do it, you know, like, get some friends and, you know, make a movie. I started out just making total crap, and now I make slightly polished crap.
Oh, you, come on, tell us what you really think.
Well, you know, as an artist...
Yeah.
The process pretty much goes, you have the greatest idea for a movie or project, and you're making it, and you're in production, and you're like, this is going to be the best ever, and then you get post-production, and you're editing, and it's like, well, we have to cut some corners, and, you know, some stuff's not as good as I'd like it, but it's still pretty good.
Yeah.
And then the film gets finished, and you start submitting to film festivals and getting all your rejection letters, and you're like, it's the worst movie ever made, I'm the worst.
Yeah.
And then you get another idea, and the cycle starts all over again.
Yeah. Unless, of course, you're Tom...
But any artist, like, will go through probably the same exact stuff. You know, if you're a painter, you're a musician, it doesn't matter. You probably think your work is crap.
Mm. Unless, of course, you're Tommy Wiseau.
Yeah, he just doesn't... I don't know what he thinks, but I do know he's got to be enjoying the ride at this point.
Man, who would have thought that movie would have the life that it has had? It's
That's crazy. And did you see the Disaster Artist?
Yes, yeah, totally. Great film.
I thought it was amazing. It was like, the guy's story is like simultaneously hilarious and inspiring.
Yeah.
Like, I left that movie and I'm like, man, I can't wait to start another film.
Yeah, it is. I too found it like strange. I when I did a little review, I said it was sort of strangely uplifting. because
yeah, it was uplifting, and yet it's kind of making fun of the guy.
Yeah, like I mean, I don't think Franco. I mean, I think Franco channels him beautifully, but. You know, at the same time, you walk that fine line, like, you know, because people are essentially laughing at him. You know, they're not laughing with him; they're laughing at him in some instances. But you know, at the same time, he's got this wonderful oblivious nature that seems to, I don't know, like, you know, he's who he is, and that's all he's ever going to be. And like he says, you know, this
yeah. And I mean, you got to respect that, because there's being comfortable in your own skin is something that almost everyone I know is working hard to try to do.
Yeah, and I mean, like he says, and has been quoted famously, you know, this is my movie, this is my life, be cool, you know. You know,
it's bizarre. And by the way, anyone listening, if you haven't seen it, I mean, I recommend you watch The Room first.
Yes.
But you don't have to.
No, I don't. I
know plenty of people that only saw The Disaster Artist and they really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, I saw The Room. I read the book first before I saw the film.
Damn.
Yeah. Which was
you did your homework.
Yeah, and so I was very interested. And the adaptation is a wonderful adaptation of the story, and it's yeah, like I said, my first when I came out, just strangely uplifting, stuck with me. I think, you know. In a town where everyone is trying to get noticed, you know, it's almost like Whitnall and I.
Oh, I know.
He's almost like the Whitnall and I of filmmakers. You know, we've gone on holiday by mistake. You know, we've become sort of a phenomenon by mistake. You know, like, because I don't think anyone sets out to make a bad movie. You know, no one sets out.
No.
To make...
No, I don't think. I mean, there might be a few, but everyone tries, and it's just the thing about film. And I try to avoid reading negative reviews of my film, but I also want to tell them, like, do you have any idea how hard that was? Like,
yeah.
Like when you get out there, nothing's going right. It's just it's brutal.
Hmm. I noticed that among your
and you spend a year of your life working your ass off to make this movie, usually for very little money. It's just an independent film.
Mm.
Of course I didn't want it to turn out crappy. Of course I thought it would be better. Of course.
I noticed among your credits that you're part of a forthcoming documentary called. Deals and Visions, which I'm interested to have a look at, which talks about you know, producing in the current climate. And
probably I don't know which project that is specifically. I've done a lot of interviews for a lot of documentaries and things.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, I don't know how I usually don't like to use IMDb because it's sometimes unreliable, but yeah, just said you did it. You're one of the featured people in this documentary called Deals and Visions, which I mean, there's some other producers in there. There's Edward Pressman that's been interviewed for it, and a few other you know, about, you know, trying to get, you know, movies off the ground, obviously, in this this fairly brutal climate that's in Hollywood at the moment.
Oh, it's extremely brutal. And it's like, people who don't work in the industry, you know, you see the glitz and glamour, of course. You see the people on the red carpet, and they're making, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars, and, you know, driving all these great cars. But really, the industry itself is, like, full of mostly normal people that, you know, live paycheck to paycheck, or, you know, are middle class, maybe. And, you know, it's always a struggle. But most people aren't, like, the press are upset about it. It's like, we're trying to do what we love.
Yeah.
For a living. And, you know, if we can make a living at all, 95% of us are very happy just doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying it's a tough racket, everybody. It's very tough. And a lot of it's just luck.
Yeah. I mean, I was reading recently, you might have seen online yourself as well, about this whole thing surrounding that movie Bright, you know, that Will Smith movie?
Oh, Bright, yes.
Yeah, and I mean, that's an interesting story, and I mean, I was talking with someone the other day, like, the whole, you know, the concept of, like, they sent out, you know, there was someone, you know, paid people for negative press, to you know, to surround it and this sort of thing, and then all of a sudden, you know, because they're, you know, I think in some ways Hollywood's sort of terrified of this Netflix sort of business model where they don't have to worry about distribution. I mean, that's they've got their
right.
Own,
they're the gatekeepers now.
Yeah, and I mean they've been developing their own original stuff for a long time, so Hollywood's been ignoring it for a while, and I just think now it's come to the chickens have come home to roost in some respect.
Well, that's why Disney bought I can't say it for sure, it's not like I was in the room, but the belief and word on the street is that a big reason Disney bought 21st Century Fox and is buying up all these properties and consolidating them is because they're interested in creating their own streaming service to compete with Netflix and Amazon.
Right, yeah.
And it's like, you know, they're going to have Star Wars and all the Marvel films and all this other, you know, top-tier stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you're gonna make some noise for sure.
Yeah. Because, I mean, if you want to watch those particular properties, you'll have to have, you know, whatever their service will be called.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they'll just call it, like, you know, Disney Stream or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. So,
I hope they call it something, like, ambiguous, like D-Stream. And then we can kind of make fun of it.
Mickey Leakes. But,
watch it on the D!
Yeah. The Disney Channel. or the Ultimate Disney Channel or whatever, but I thought it was very interesting the furor that surrounded that movie, and but you know, you hear the critical lambasting first, and then the audience reaction's totally different. And I mean, the fact that they had something like, you know, whether these figures are true or not, something like 11 million people watched it in the first weekend. Because that's when it premiered on Netflix, you know, so you could just stream it, you know. I believe they had some, like a small theatrical release first, but
they do that with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Now more and more theatrical releases just act as like an advertisement for the home video release.
Yeah. You know, and I just think that you know, it's a very, you know, I think it's the future. I think, you know, they're not worried about the old fashioned way of getting your film out there. They can get the movies out there, that, you know, because anyone who's got Netflix can you get these
It's really cool, and it's a reason I really like YouTube, in all honesty, as a platform. There's a lot of creativity on there, and like some of the stuff is kind of shoddy. It's not real well polished, but it's still really enjoyable.
Yeah.
And it's neat just to see all the talent out there.
Yeah.
But again, at the same time, it makes it very hard to stand out.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, as a filmmaker myself, if you look back in the 80s when people completed an independent film,
sure,
even if it was crappy, here's your check for $1 million because we need stuff on VHS.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And now they pay very little for films. It's very difficult to make a film that makes its money back.
Yeah. Now I had some friends who reported back to me about the film market over the last couple of years that you have there in California, and they said it's very it's very lean and mean at the moment, and they're essentially only interested in films that are made. You know, like you've gone out and done the work, so it's almost like someone coming around to your house. They're just coming around to your house to eat the food. They're not interested in helping you cook it. They just want to eat.
Right, and as a filmmaker, obviously our priority is to make our money back, but a lot of us just want our stuff to get seen. So, you know, we end up taking not great deals to get it out there.
Yeah. Because, I mean, obviously...
I think what you'll see more and more in the future is filmmakers distributing their own film.
Yeah.
Because for roughly $3,000 to $5,000 in fees, I can put my movie and its trailer and its artwork on all the main sites. You know, like it can go up on Amazon, iTunes, Google Play,
right,
Xbox Video, all the main places, and then I keep all the money that it makes. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think
the distribution model now is distributors keep 90% of the money that comes in.
Yeah.
If they report that it made any money.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's definitely, with what you're talking about and also what Netflix and the like are doing, I mean, I'm not saying the theatrical experience will vanish. I still think people relish and enjoy the theatrical going to the movies. I mean, I don't think that will ever die, but I think that ultimately we're talking about a business whose prime directive is about making money. So
hence the business.
Yeah. So I think they have a smaller theatrical release for films because ultimately they know that the bulk of the viewership and the money they're going to make back is through some sort of streaming service anyway. So, you know, it's eventually just going to hurt the people who make money off films as far as, you know, being distributors, you know, because everyone's going to have their own, you know, distribution service, like you said, eventually. Like, independents can go, don't have to go through a distributor. You can, like you said, you can put it up on multiple platforms and get your film out there that way, and you keep the money, And hopefully word of mouth, you know, generates, you know, good things.
Yeah, and that's the real trick, and the thing you can't get around as an independent filmmaker is publicity. Publicity is key. And I'll tell you, even when you sell your film to, you know, a distributor like Lionsgate or one of those companies, you know, Gravitas, any of those companies that puts out indie films, by and large, like, they're not going to really advertise your film. Like, they're just going to put it out.
Yeah.
So, like, as a filmmaker, like, you still have to do a ton of press yourself.
Yeah.
And if, like, a lot of people don't hear about your movie and see it, it's not going to make money, and it, you know, it just kind of dies.
Hmm. Well, certainly, I couldn't help but notice it. It certainly came like a small tidal wave across social media. is your most recent film, Snake Out of Compton. And it's
gimmicky tight, and that's what I loved about it. Like right off the bat, when the idea was dropped in my lap by the company that wanted us to make this film, and it's called Snake Out of Compton. Yeah. Like right off the bat, I'm like, yeah, I'm in.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of people think when they see the title too. They're like, I have to see this. It's either going to be the stupidest thing I've ever seen, or the funniest thing.
Yeah.
And the good news for you guys is it's both.
Yeah.
We definitely aimed to make it ridiculous. It's not Sharknado ridiculous.
Right.
We did try to put a little more into the story and characters, but never losing sight of the fact that it's called Snake Out of Compton. It has to be stupid.
Yeah.
And if something's not stupid in the movie, it's not funny enough.
Yeah. It's also a little bit refreshing to see the return of the snakes. I mean, we've had a lot of sharks. The snakes are coming back. We had snakes on a plane.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, on a VFX budget, it's a lot easier to do snakes than it is to do sharks.
I mean, I'm a fan of Sharknado as well, but I mean, it's nice to see that it was refreshing to see it wasn't sharks. I mean, because there's been so many.
Everyone loves sharks because sharks are probably the scariest creature in nature.
Yeah.
In terms of like, you know, large scale will eat you.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, obviously spiders are, you know, nobody likes spiders. Or,
yeah.
You know, if ants were the size of cars, that would be terrifying, but you know, none of that's realistic. Sharks, that's real. They got those jagged ass teeth. Like nobody wants to get bit by a shark.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, you know, a spider's... did you see the Lavalantula movies?
I did, actually. I'm actually in the first one.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah, I she probably... In fact, nobody would recognize me because I'm wearing a mask, so
okay.
I don't know what I was thinking. But I play a guy dressed as, like, a spider in the scene where the spiders are terrorizing Hollywood Boulevard.
Okay.
And I try to spray silly string at him, and it doesn't work.
All right, awesome.
I'm actually, I'm pretty good friends with the director, Mike Mendez.
Yeah, I've interviewed Mike. He's a nice bloke.
He's awesome. And, you know, obviously, everything he makes is very fun.
Yeah.
And Big Ass Spider kind of inspired me a bit after I had done Chemical Peel and Unnatural.
Yeah.
In the sense that, like, it's a very fun film, and it's a crowd-pleasing film. And even though I'm proud of Chemical Peel, I think it's a really solid movie.
Yeah.
It's a bummer, you know, because it's a survival horror film, and it's, you know, it's all about these people dying, basically.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people like that kind of thing, and if you like a good slow burn and a drama, I think you'll really enjoy it, but it's not something I ever want to watch again, you know what I mean? Like,
right, yeah.
When it's a fun movie, like Big Ass Spider or Snake Out of Compton, you can pop it on at any point and watch the rest of it or just watch for 10 minutes while you're getting ready to go and enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, that's obviously part of their, part of the draw card, too, is, you know, these types of films are, you know, they're fast, they're funny, they're obviously, you know, the best thing about these, what are essentially, you know, B-grade type movies, is they are winking at the audience.
No offense taken, sir. We're all very proud of the fact that we make B-movies.
I love B-movies. I think,
I know, but I know you're kind of, you tiptoed around it. It's like, nah, we're B-movies. It's a creature feature. It's what we do.
Yeah, I mean, I think, right up until... You know, talking about sharks, I mean, Jaws was essentially like a B-movie done on a big budget.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, Alien, another one, that's a creature feature.
Yeah.
But it's just so well done.
Yeah.
That it elevates, and now it's, you know, it's an A-list film.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I mean, I think without the B picture, the A pictures aren't, you know, really... You know, I mean, let's face it. A lot of the big cinema filler summer fodder. You know, it was stuff like The Core and The Cave and stuff like that. These are essentially B movies done, you know, big and glossy.
Armageddon, even. You know, it's a silly concept, but it's fun.
You know, I mean, I don't know whether you've heard the that great line in the commentary where Ben Affleck's talking about, he asked Michael Bay, he said, why is it easier to send, wouldn't it be easier to train astronauts to drill than it would be oil drillers to be astronauts? And Michael Bay said, shut the fuck up, Ben.
Because the ridiculousness of the plot is part of the fun.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a staple of you know, I mean, I personally think that there's such a, it's like you were saying about your first film, this, you know you're pleased with it, but there's a seriousness to it, and I think today there's an awful cloud of seriousness around the, you know, these films are so dark and serious, you know, like. And I think it's hurting a lot of these bigger movies, you know. There's a lack of levity.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when they watch a film, you know, they want to, it's escapism. It's like you want to forget about problems for a while and just have a good time. And, you know, to that end, that's why you make fun films. Now, I also enjoy, you know, the very artistic and dramatic films, you know, I have a lot of respect for their craftsmanship and that kind of thing, but, you know, I'm not gonna lie, I see, like, a low-budget zombie movie come out, I'm like, well, I'm gonna check that out, I kind of enjoy the schlockiness of it.
Yeah, because, you know, because it's fun, and it's winking at you, it knows exactly what it is, it's not pretending to be anything else. I mean, some of the best movies are the movies that have endured, or the movies that enjoy cult status. Are these kinds of films? I mean, you know, like we were talking about The Room before. Now, The Room, I don't know whether it was meant to be serious or not, but it plays hilarious. People laugh their ass off at it, you know. But
it's also again, to anyone who's listening here, the interesting experience with that film is, sure, it's funny because it's not what it intended to be, but it's also a very bizarre film, and it's kind of mesmerizing because as you watch it unfold, you're kind of like, what are they thinking here? And I don't even mean that like you idiot, but honestly, there's something very interesting going on into the thought process of what's happening, and you're like, what was the thought process when I wrote this part and put this part together? Like, it's so strange.
Yeah, but it's supremely. I don't know. I think that's still the great cloud that hangs over all artistic people. Is that once you know what you want to create, you know what you're striving to do, but ultimately at the end you've got to turn it over to an audience who are going to tell you again what you've done, and they're going to tell you what you've done, what this is, and they're going to embrace it or they're not, and they're going to be responsible for the how long the film lives or dies. But the grey cloud is still, it's a great confounding mystery, about why it works, or why do films fail, why do films succeed, you know? There's a lot of people...
And again, it goes back to, as I said earlier, luck. Like,
yeah.
When you set out to make a film, you can put all the right pieces in place, but you still don't know for sure what the audience is going to be looking for a year from now.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a year before your film is done.
Yeah. And then again, once it's out, you know, is it going to be something that will endure? Like, you know, like the, I remember during the whole, when the Blade Runner sequel came out earlier last year now. Sorry, 2018, people. when the Blade Runner sequel came out last year, there was it was critically well received. The audience reaction was mixed. But I remember saying to someone, I said, let us not forget that the first Blade Runner was not a darling when it came out in cinemas. It took 30 years for that film to achieve the status that it has.
Yeah. Some works of art, as it's always been, are just ahead of their time.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, people hated Empire Strikes Back when it came out.
Yes.
It's, you know, so dark.
Yeah. And I mean, The Last Jedi has received its equal share of praise and,
You know, it's an interesting film. It's a bizarre dichotomy because it's caught between a film that's clearly trying to cash in on nostalgia and just make money for Disney, but at the same time, I think that the writer-director was kind of clever, and he pretty much flushed a lot of ideas down the toilet.
Yeah.
And I'm really surprised they let him get away with that, because it's kind of screwed up that trilogy.
Yes.
It's like, in the where does the third one go, you know?
Yeah.
In the original trilogy, and even in the prequel trilogy, you know, every film builds towards something. You can kind of see where it's going, and then it's heading for a certain climax. But it's like, all bets are off on this one. I have no idea what the third one is going to be about, and that's kind of cool.
Yeah. And maybe that was their plan too, you don't know. But I personally feel or felt like when I came out of it that this kind of feels like more of the end of a trilogy than the beginning. Than the middle.
Yeah, it really did.
And I thought
but, it's just Disney film it's Disney Star Wars film number 4 out of, 76. they're gonna keep going.
Everyone's gonna be so sick of Star Wars in
20 years, you're not gonna know what to do with yourself.
Oh, look, the Star Wars slot machine is paying out well, and while it is, they're gonna pump quarters into that thing like it's no one's business. but
true, and it's like I'll talk shit about it, but when a Star Wars movie comes out, you can bet I'm gonna go see it.
Oh, look, anyone of certainly of our generation that grew up with it, it's pretty hard to pass up when, the new trailer's out or something. and you stop, I've got to watch it, and like, they're wearing cowboy hats. Oh, wait. Woohoo!
It's interesting. Like, I try to avoid trailers when I know I'm going to see the movie.
Yeah.
But... you still can't avoid the trailer. Like, oh man, what's it gonna be?
Yeah, I think the mark. Like, I know that there was a lot of talk around, don't watch the trailers, don't do this, don't do that. But I think they were very clever. I think the campaign was very good at its misdirection, because it was leading you in a certain way, and then of course the film comes along and goes completely in the other direction. So I don't know whether that was part of the thing that created some sort of the backlash.
It is sometimes, it all depends, because typically, the marketing arm is not always at all in sync with the filmmakers.
True.
A lot of times the filmmakers are really upset with how their film has been marketed. Sometimes it's really bad. Like the Terminator Genesis marketing, for example, was pretty bad. Of course, the movie wasn't very good either, but the trailer gave away every single plot twist.
But I mean, that's a couple of hours of my life I'll never get back. That movie. oh goodness.
Speaking of which, side note, I got my 4K Terminator 2 Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah?
Sitting here, so
awesome.
I'll be popping that in this weekend.
Awesome, yeah. Why not? That's a great night in. But I mean,
I think it's, in my opinion, it's the greatest action film of all time, but that could just be me.
Yeah, I think there's been something inherently lost. I might be wrong, the filmmakers that are today, like yourself, inspired by the films that we grew up watching. There's always going to be there's always going to be
Spielberg and Lucas and that generation were inspired by completely different films of like the 40s and 50s, and then they turned around and changed everything in the 70s, and then now you're seeing all the filmmakers that were inspired by Spielberg and Lucas, and they're making totally different stuff, and in some cases the exact same thing, but
and then, of course,
20 years from now film will be even different.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, today, like, in this climate at the moment with, like, Stranger Things and stuff like that, there's the nostalgia card getting thrown around a fair bit. But I think there's a need now to go somewhere else. Take what has inspired us and move in a different direction, as it says in the screenwriting book, the Save the Cat, it says, I want the same but different.
I'm sorry, was that a question?
I was just commenting. I was saying that it's...
Okay, I thought you posed me a question. I was like, I don't know how I feel about that.
I was just commenting the fact that it seems to be, like that book says, it's, they want the same but different.
Yeah, I mean, the saying has long been that, there's only 9 stories or only 12 different stories, and everything's just a different interpretation of those. And I guess to an extent that's true, but it's always interesting to see different versions of them. I mean, it's like the way theater used to be. It was interesting to see another take on a production. It's like, oh, they're doing a production of that play, et cetera. And you like to see it go in new directions. And it's the same way with film.
Totally. And I think I think it's going to be interesting. Like obviously, while something is making money, they'll keep making sequels. Or in the case of Disney with Star Wars, while Star Wars keeps making billions of dollars, they'll keep making Star Wars films. But it'll
most likely.
Yeah. But I mean,
if someone's making money, who wants to stop making money?
That's true. But I mean, I think Hollywood's going to reach a point again, like it did prior to the new Hollywood in the 70s, where this machine that exists. I mean, Before this, it was the golden age of the studio system, with their big budget epics and musicals and all that sort of stuff. It will come to a head at some point. The audience will say, "Oh, look, I'm just sick of this. I want to see something else."
You would think.
Yeah.
You would think, but I feel like we would have reached that by now.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you're right. I'm sure it's coming.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it'll probably be as drastic as that. Like, everyone will just stop and say, we'll boycott going to the movies until you give us something different. But they'll obviously, like, they won't just continually accept, what they're given, unless it's Star Wars, But, I mean, once we get up to Terminator 20, It's or Jaws 19 or 16 or whatever it was.
Rocky 5,000.
That's it. Rocky 5,000. As a cameo, we have the taxidermied body of Sylvester Stallone in the background somewhere.
we're at a point where those actors are never going to go away.
Yeah.
The CGI technology, and once they've recorded their voice enough, like, you're just going to have them forever.
I know, yeah. It's kind of interesting and scary in a little bit of ways, you know, like, you can die and essentially, you know, oh, we need him for a film. So they ring up the family, hey, we, you know, we know that your father, uncle, grandfather, whoever, has been dead for, you know, 20 years or so, but we kind of need him for this role.
I wonder how that'll work. I wonder if people will just sign their life rights away.
Yeah. I mean, I can see for certain stars it would be a great, you know, for those that are tremendously, you know, a vanity thing, like, oh, yes, I can, I'll be still making movies long after I'm dead. you know, and, you know.
Well, I think there's something to that. I mean, as self-centered, narcissistic as it is, a lot of us just kind of want to make something that, you know, we're remembered for. It's like it's our way to get a little bit of mortality.
I mean, everyone's, you know, I said before, you know, of Hollywood, you know, it's in a town where everyone's trying to get noticed. But I think, you know, we really live in, we've always lived in a world where everyone's trying to get noticed for something before their numbers are called. So it's, you know, I mean, it's always been about a slice of, like, I want to leave something behind. So, you know, I mean, there's always been that element to it, but I mean, you know, this, what we're talking about here is, like you said, you know, very sort of, potentially a very narcissistic thing, like, you know, I mean, you know, you know, Stallone sort of wakes up one morning and says, hey, yeah, we could keep making Rocky movies well into, like, the next century, so I'll sign my likeness and my voice.
Wow, that was the best Stallone impersonation I've ever heard. Awesome.
Oh, really? Thank you. Actually,
I'm sorry. It wasn't bad. I'm sorry. I bust your balls.
No, that's cool. No.
I will say, all filmmakers have an ego, you know, we're all a bit narcissistic. If we're artists, it's what drives you. If you don't have an ego, you're probably not trying to be in this industry.
Yeah. Do you know Sandy Kalara?
I don't know him, but I am very familiar with him.
You know of him, yeah. I tell you what, he
had a very popular fan film back in the day when I was doing fan films. And,
yeah.
That Batman Dead End was always kind of like the gold standard for me.
Yeah, that, I tell you what, Sandy does the hands down best Stallone I've ever heard. Hands down. I'll send you a link to the interview I did with him. You want to hear his
story? You know what? I'd love it.
Yeah.
It's funny, my DP, director of photography on Snake Out of Compton, does a fantastic Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Really?
And as it turns out, so does our sound guy, the guy holding the boom.
Okay, cool.
And so a lot of times on set, you would just hear all these Arnold voices, like, well, let's go ahead, let's shoot this, let's do it. But, like, imagine that, but, like, the good version. And it's like you can't even concentrate after a while.
Yeah. Apparently, I have a friend who made a film with Dolph Lundgren. Apparently, Dolph Lundgren does a really good Clint Eastwood.
I'll have to ask Mike Mendez.
Yeah. I mean, my friend Scott Windhauser, he recently directed a Dead Trigger, it's called. It's based on a video game. Dolph's the lead guy in it. And, yeah, apparently he said Dolph does a really good Clint Eastwood shtick, so it's, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. You know, he's not, you know, I mean, I've heard Mel Gibson do Clint Eastwood. He does Clint Eastwood pretty well, but Dolph Lundgren, I didn't picture him for a good Clint Eastwood, but anyway. But, no, Snake Out of Compton.
Well, I think he's got a lot of talent. I mean, you got to give him that. Like,
oh, yeah, totally.
No matter what you think of
the film, totally.
The talent he's got. So.
It'll be
great. I'm not surprised.
I tell you, what'll be really great to see is Dolph back in, like, a big movie. Like, he's going to be in that Aquaman movie. the standalone Aquaman movie. So it'll be cool to see him.
Very familiar. I know the filmmaker is doing that as well.
Oh, James Wan, yeah. James is a nice bloke.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That is very true.
Yeah. But, no, it'll be great to see Dolph in a big big movie again after sort of being, you know, in the VODs for a while.
That's true. I like him a lot. I thought he was the best part of Expendables.
Yeah. And, of course, like in he was really good in Mike's film, what is it, Don't Kill It?
Yeah, you see it? It's a very fun film.
Yeah.
He's great in it.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome little movie. Because when I interviewed Mike and I said, you know, what are your two big, what are the films obviously that influence you? And he said, well, it's close. It's like, it's Evil Dead and Raiders of the Lost Ark. And so it's great to see sort of those two, you know, I mean, you know, there's not a whole lot of Raiders, there's a little bit, but, you know, it's interesting to see those influences come to bear a little bit on Don't Kill It. So, yeah, it was a great film.
Absolutely. I mean, and not to just plug my own project again, but, you know, something you'll see a lot of in Snake Out of Compton, which you could probably even gather from the trailer, there's a lot of 80s influences in that. You know, Ghostbusters is a big one. Obviously,
because
I put a little of that into everything I do.
Yeah. That's awesome.
There's some Star Wars. There's all kinds of shit. If you like 80s movies, if you like Predator, you'll probably enjoy it.
Yeah.
In a totally different way, of course.
Hank, my friend, I have no doubt. Snake Out of Compton. Looks like it's going to be really awesome. So how is it coming out? Is it coming out, is it going to go theatrical at all, or is it going to be streaming, or how?
It'll almost certainly be streaming, as it goes with most independent, you know, low-budget creature features.
Right.
Because it's very hard to get your film into a theater unless, you know, you have A-list talent attached and, you know, big budget. And I get it. It's like, if I'm going to go to the theater and pay $15, you know, I want to see them push an envelope. I want to see, what does that money get you? You know, what is this huge budget getting us? How great is it?
Yeah. But it looks, mate, look, like I said, it came across like this great little tidal wave through social media and immediately caught my eye. And seems like my kind of movie.
I think you'll enjoy it. It's got its blemishes as any film does, but I'm really proud of it, and it's my favorite film that I've done.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, as a sense of accomplishment, but I mean, it's my favorite film that I've done that I actually like to watch.
Yeah. It looks really incredible. It looks like you said, a great blitz of fun lunacy. nostalgia, that sort of stuff. So it's everything a grown boy needs, part of your complete breakfast. Snake Out of Compton. So when does that officially arrive around the world? Or
they're still working out a deal, and it should, you know, ideally it'll probably be out early summer.
Okay.
Even once a film is sold and all the details are worked out, it's usually, you know, 6 months or more before it actually comes out.
Right, yeah. But, the campaign's good, it's strong. I wish nothing but the best for you. I hope it, comes out big. It looks like it's got, it looks like a movie that could have, sort of instant cult status around it. It seems like one of those movies. And, hopefully.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm totally happy, you know, making that stuff. You know, it's like, would I like to win an Oscar, make, you know, tens of millions of dollars? Sure, who won it? But
like, if I can just make a living and keep, you know, making fun, goofy stuff, you know, you can't ask for more than that, really.
Oh, totally. Totally. And hopefully it does well enough, we'll get Snake out of Compton 2. Or another...
really hope we get a sequel, because we've already outlined
another storyline for it. Yeah.
It's even way more ridiculous than this one, and I will just say it it deals with time travel as well.
Oh, wow. Well, mate, we need time travel. We always need time travel. I love the end of the...
Yeah.
I love the end of the most recent, what was it, Sharknado 5? With the whole, with Dolph Lundgren comes back with a Humvee, and,
That's what I'm talking about, man. Just fun shit. That's the goal.
You turned the Sharknado into a time machine. Well done, son. crazy stuff. But I love it. Snake out of Compton, and hopefully, I don't know, Snake out of Compton 2, we call it Snakes out of Compton, or another Snake out of Compton.
I thought about saying Snakes out of Compton, taking the alien route, but I think I want to call it Snake out of Time.
Snake out of Time, yeah. Dig it, yeah, totally.
If I had my way, and I rarely do, that's what it would be.
Totally, that's awesome. Hank, mate, you've been very generous with your time this morning. I wish you nothing but the best with this film coming out soon. I love your work, mate. I can't wait to see more of it. Thank you for being on Podcasting Softly.
Of course, always fun to talk shop.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love to talk with brilliant up-and-comers such as yourself. I hope the future is I hope the future is all but glorious. Hey.
Sorry. I will take the compliment, sure. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I think you've got the skills, my friend. I mean, it just, it's, who knows? Like I said, it's a mystery. The right film at the right place at the right time, and you'll go stratospheric.
It's impossible to predict. We'll just keep swinging for the fences.
That's right. Swinging for the fences. You heard it here, folks. Snake out of Compton coming out, I was going to say next year. I keep forgetting it's 2018 already.
Summer 2018.
Yeah, summer. It's summer this year. It's 2018. I keep forgetting it's 2018. I keep saying next year, but it's this year. Snake out of Compton, my guest, Hank Braxton. Thank you for being on the show again, mate. And we look forward to the big Snake movie. And hopefully a lot more. And everything else you're doing, I wish you the best of luck with as well.
Thank you so much.
All right, mate. Thank you very much.